Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of The Week That Really Was for the week ending the 10th of May, 2024. My name is John McGurk. Her name is Sarah Ryan. And this is a weekly podcast that discusses the events of the week just gone. Before I say hello to Sarah, I just want to deal with a couple of announcements. One of the top comments on the podcast last week was a request to have various candidates on this show. Now, obviously, Sarah is working for one of those candidates, so she can't do that. So over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to do separate interviews with a series of European election candidates, give you about 30 minutes with all of them, and try and highlight people who maybe aren't getting the kind of coverage that you'd expect on RTE or the Irish Times. The first person will be Patrick Tobin, who I'm going to be speaking to today. And that will be out early next week. So that's just something to keep an eye out for. Sarah, how are you doing?
Good. On the campaign trail, a load of people coming over and asking about and saying they listen to the podcast. So if you're listening to this and that was one of you, thanks. It's really cool.
It is. It is. And I meant to say last week to the person who came up to me in the BlackRock clinic of all places where I was visiting somebody 2 weeks ago and said that they love the podcast. I was obviously with my wife and my sister-in-law at the time, and I probably should have stopped and said more to you than I did, but I really appreciated that. Thank you so much. Speaking of people giving us feedback, let's go through some of the comments from the last week. And we normally go to YouTube, but let's go to the Gripped website where people also leave comments. Sean Kennedy says, if he has one issue with this podcast, though he enjoys it, it's that John and Sarah are way too nice to people who despise them. John wants respectability politics when only one side is willing to do that. This leftists, especially hard leftists, despise you, he says. And he says, not every right-wing argument needs to be argued on after a million precursors of course we're not extremists, of course we're not evil. Leftists don't care and will hate you regardless. He might have a point there.
Fair. I think that's fair. But we're not trying, I don't think, this is the thing as well, we're not trying to be nice to left-wing people, we just are nice. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to be horrible to people.
Yeah, well, I have a policy. I never write anything I don't believe. Like, yeah. And I actually get in rows with readers far more often than anyone else at Gripped. And I'm not saying other people at Gripped don't write what they believe, but like, I think it's important that the readers and indeed the listeners to this podcast know that you're getting our honest opinions. And if you disagree with them, tough titties, basically. But when you agree with them, know that they're also our honest opinions. We're not pandering to you. I think the worst thing we could do is start pandering to people and pretending that we believe things just because we think they might be popular. Speaking of saying things that aren't popular, I'm afraid the old issue of you saying various words too much has come up again. Apparently you say like and you know far too much. That is a regular complaint. And I think it's unfair, by the way, that Sarah gets targeted with that because I do the same thing and no one ever complains.
I know it's not as bad. I've listened to it back and it is very bad. And I'm irritated by myself. I'm much worse than you at that. But I don't even notice that I'm doing it.
Yeah.
It's when I get very passionate about something, I find that I say it more and I don't even realize because I'm on one of my mad ones, you know?
Yeah. And look, I think the problem is everybody who speaks like that. Everyone has their own verbal tic and you don't notice it until it's played back to you. Moving over to YouTube. I mean, I'm not going to read out the praise ones, but thank you to people like Sean McGabriel who are saying that they support Gripped financially. We couldn't survive without you. And I really do appreciate this. Somebody called Grania says she doesn't really care. It doesn't really agree with me that my point about campaigns needing to be professional. I said last week I got in a little bit of trouble because I said I didn't think John Waters had a chance of winning the election. I stand over that. But there are some people out there who believe that it doesn't really matter about posters and all the rest of it, that the mood is such in the country that, you know, being a clear alternative is more important. I don't know, sir. I don't think I agree.
I think that there's an element of truth to the fact that you can be in the moment of the moment and your campaign can cost less, be smaller and just be taken up on a tide of whatever the mood of the moment is. That's for sure. And some elements of campaigns, and we've spoken about this earlier today, actually, you know, some elements of campaigns, let's take posters, for example, are fueled a lot by candidate campaign team anxiety that, you know, it matters, that, you know, there's going to be some kind of, you know, people aren't going to know you're running if they don't hear from you and see from you all the time. And that's not necessarily true. All of those things are true. But I think that there's a terrible thing that can happen. When you're in politics and you're involved in politics, or you're just an anorak who loves politics and watches politics, you have a far inflated sense of how much people are paying attention to politics than they really are. And I think a lot of candidates suffer from the fear that people will not know that they are running if they don't get their name out there enough. So I think you can be carried up on a tide for sure. And you don't, people get lucky and they don't have to spend money. But at the same time, there's always that concern that, you know, if you lose by 100 or 50 votes and you had no posters and you had no this and you had no that, I guarantee you would have got elected if you just had the posters.
Yeah, it's 100% true. It's 100% true. And by the way, I just want to mention that thing about candidate interviews. About three different people said, after I said with John Waters, they said, will you have John Waters on and interview him? What I'm going to say this directly about John Waters, because I think it's important to be clear and honest with the viewers. John Waters has written over the last 3 or 4 years some horrendous things about me personally and Grit Media. And I don't hold that against him. He's entitled to his opinion. I'm going to say this publicly. If he wants to come on and do a candidate interview, be delighted to talk to him. Delighted to talk to him, but he can reach out and he can get in touch. I'm not going to chase after him. So that's just the open offer that I'm going to put out there on that. And we'll have a frank conversation, and you know, and I will ask him questions that I think are important and that I think he should answer as a candidate. But these airwaves are not denied to him if he wishes to access them. Anyway, we talked about politics an awful lot.
Spoiler alert, he won't.
Well, we'll see. Let's talk about something other than politics. We've talked about politics about for enough, and these elections for about the last 3 or 4 weeks. We're probably going to do it moving forward. For the week that's in it, though, let's talk some culture. What do you make of the Eurovision? Was that hard? What do you make of Ireland's Eurovision entry? Is that a fair question?
Not my cup of tea. Is that okay? Can I say that? I don't want to be mean. I think it's another example of the Emperor's New Clothes. I don't think the song is musical or good, personally. And I think it's pantomime and not in a good way.
I really wanted to hate it.
Okay.
I really wanted to hate it. For those reasons, because like we all have this kind of culture war thing in our heads, right? Like you see dancing in the trans flag, you know, she's waving the trans flag instead of the Irish flag when it's over. And then I sat down and I read the song. Didn't listen to it, I read it, read what she's saying. And I have a piece on this on Gripped yesterday now, on Thursday. And I think it's really interesting. And it's repulsive to everything I believe, but I think it's really interesting because she's singing this song, which is basically, on the face of it, she's cursing an ex-boyfriend. She's like, I'm placing this kind of witchcraft spell on you that you might never be happy again. But then you read the lyrics and she's actually cursing herself. She's saying, you know, I want to get rid of my memories. I want to get rid of, sorry, now Sarah being a bit blue, but she says, I want to get rid of the parts of myself that I touch in bed at night. I want to get rid of my fondness and my desire for you. And it strikes me, it's a song about self-destruction. And I thought it was really interesting when you see her dancing there in the trans flag. This is somebody who's come out as non-binary in recent years. And I think when you read it, it all clicked for me. Like this is about, and a lot of what we're seeing in society at the moment is about this desire to obliterate who you are and be reborn as someone new. And it's a song about deep unhappiness. And I kind of, as I read it, I kind of understood where she's coming from. And I kind of feel sorry for her more than anything else. And it's a strange thing to say about somebody who's having great cultural success, but like it didn't read to me like the words of a happy person.
Well, I mean, lots of people have cultural success and they're deeply unhappy. By the way, I love the way you've referred to her as she, without any kind of attempt to, you know, play along with the they them thing. Also, can I just talk a little bit about the what's the name of that singer who's also non-binary? Sam Smith.
Yes. Right?
What is this kind of obsession with Satanism and pentagons? And is it? It's just kind of, to me, it all seems a little bit like childish goths from 20 years ago gone wild. Like, do you know what I mean? It's a pentagon and she's screaming at the press conference that she's queer and she's a witch. And well, you're not, actually. You're not a witch because it's not.
Can you do magic?
That's not real.
You can't do magic. You're not a witch.
Funny.
But like,
it's the whole, it's just deliberately trying to be a kind of an attention-seeking, sad, angry teenager screaming, jumping up and down and screaming for attention. And It bores me. Sorry.
Well, if I've learned one thing as I've grown up, Sarah, it's that, like, I kind of feel unique in a way because I am a genuine agnostic. I never describe myself as an atheist because I think as an atheist, you have to commit to the idea that there's no God. This is the only life and there's nothing thereafter. I can't commit to that idea because I don't know. But I'm also very comfortable with the idea that there might not be a God. Like, if there's no God and this is the one life we have, then so be it. You know, one day I'll die and it'll be the exact same. I'll be the exact same position as I was before I was born. Loads of stuff will be happening. I won't know about it. That's just how I look at it. And I'm fine with that. And I'm comfortable. But what I've discovered over the years, especially looking at the decline of Catholicism in Ireland, is that there's a really deep-seated human need for religion.
Yeah.
Like it's there everywhere. And when I look at the kind of and I think in fairness to Bambi Thug, she says she's not a Satanist. She says that. She says she's not a Satanist. But like the echoes in the performance and in the imagery is very satanic and occulty. And I think
when you find this annoying people, what's the point of that?
So here's my theory. Sorry, I don't want to talk, but like, I think it is about, if you look at Christianity, what does Christianity say? Christianity says, like, follow these rules and you'll live a good life and you'll go to heaven. And if you don't follow them, you go to hell. And Satanism is kind of the opposite of that. Satanism says the rules are all a trick. You know, it goes back to the Garden of Eden where it says, look, God built this wonderful place and he told you not to eat that apple. And it's the tastiest apple in the park. That's a trick. Eat the bloody apple. And I think Satanism is a religion that kind of like, or it's a spirituality that gives you permission to go and eat the apple and live however you want. But the problem with it is that loads of people who are doing that don't feel happy in themselves at all. And that, I think that's the great paradox of our age, that loads of people are eating the apple and finding that they're empty and sad and hate themselves inside. And they're trying to find a kind of framework of meaning for that. That's my theory. I don't know if that's too highbrow for this podcast, but that's my theory.
Well, I think this is a huge, what I've noticed, and I'm 40, right? And I've noticed in the last couple of years a real uptick in people I knew growing up revisiting their religion in a major way, particularly those who were, we'd say, lost in various different ways, whether it was substances or, you know, different kind of whatever problems that you can fall into in your young and middle adulthood. And I think that it's tremendously comforting for some people. It gives them a rudder, gives them a steer, gives them direction, gives them comfort, gives them a compass, makes them feel like there's meaning to things. And good, you know, that's wonderful for them. And I know a number of people like that. I also know a number of people who fell into it who were firm atheists. One in particular, he was twice divorced, very firm atheist, and met this woman, and he's American, and fell in love with her, and she was Jewish, and he converted. So he'd been married twice already, once for a year, once for 3 years, and then he met this woman and he converted to be a Jew, and they're married now 34 years. I mean, he's nearly 80. They're married 34, 35 years or something. And he's really happy. And he says that a commitment to God saved him from depression. So it works and it makes people feel really good. But I don't think that's what's happening here. I think what's happening here is that somebody has fallen into religion. It's just that the religion is this cult of transgenderism and, you know, what you think is anti-establishment, but is actually ironically the establishment now.
My old friend and listeners to this podcast will remember our old friend, David Quinn, Sarah's predecessor in that seat. He was making a point during the week and he was like, if you were really transgressive, like if you really were rebelling against the establishment, you wouldn't have Micheál Martin saying how proud he was of you, the most establishment man in Ireland, which he did this week. So, I mean, it's clearly not anti-establishment. But I have to say, she said something during the week that made me feel really sorry for her. And I posted it on Twitter and I said, look, this is a Rorschach test. And a Rorschach test, for those of you who don't know, it's when they show you pictures and they like of shapes and they try and figure out what your personality is by what you say. Some people will say that's a butterfly. And other people will say that's a monster eating a child or whatever. You know, that's what a Rorschach test is. And it says a lot about your personality. And I thought this clip was kind of like a good Rorschach test for where you stand in society. But she's asked what makes her special. And she did this kind of thing where she said, I'm special because I'm a queer. And then she screamed out the word, I'm a witch. Like that. And I just felt, I felt so sorry for her, because like, you may be those things, love, but that's not what makes you special. And I'm not speaking as any kind of like, you were all God's children kind of religious person saying that. I'm saying it's just not. Like, you're obviously a talented writer. You're obviously a talented singer. You obviously have people in your life who love you and, you know, think the world of you. Those are the things that make you special. Like, your mom doesn't love you because you're a witch. I'm sure she loves you regardless of you being a witch, but that's not the reason, you know. And I think this kind of
nail
like,
on the head, John, nail on the head. This is what I always can never understand. Like, your sexual orientation, your becoming your identity, it's the least interesting thing about you.
Yeah.
The fact that you like women is the least interesting thing about you.
Mm.
And these young people have been bought into this thing that maybe it is based on some kind of deep insecurity that you're not interesting or good enough, so you have to be different and special. And this doesn't make you interesting or special. It's not that, it's, as you said, she's obviously a good writer. She's a performer. She has, it's not my kind of music, but that she definitely has talent. There's no doubt about that. She's a very beautiful looking young girl, whatever. And so I'm actually not doing that on purpose, but.
No, she's clearly female. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, there's no, yeah. Like, you said earlier on, I wasn't doing the, it wasn't even conscious. I mean, Bambi Thug is a woman.
I know, but I'm not trying to be mean, you know what I mean? I'm just saying, but that's all the least interesting stuff about her. And I think that that's sad, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
There's other stuff too. She said, like, not that long ago, and I mean, and I say this as a positive thing. She said a couple of months ago that she was like completely anti-drugs, completely anti kind of all that kind of scene. And she said she thought that musical performers like her had a duty to say to kids who are listening to her music, like, you know, stay away from drugs and stuff. Like that I think in that particular culture makes her a little bit special. I mean, Marilyn Manson wouldn't have said that. So, I mean, you know, I just think when you're asked that, and I mean, maybe, okay, we have to allow that maybe she was trying to play to the Eurovision audience, because, I mean, let's face it, like, I think 10% of people at the most in society are gay. In the Eurovision audience, that's like 90%. So maybe she's playing to the audience. So let's be, leave that open. But if she wasn't, I just thought it was really sad, and I felt really sorry for her in that moment, because she's still quite a young person. She's a lot younger than you and me.
I think there's a chance you can win. I don't know much about the Eurovision.
There's a chance. I mean, I think if you go and look at the comments under the YouTube video, I mean, it's really resonating. And what I find it interesting to talk is it is really resonating with loads and loads of people. Like, loads of YouTube comments saying things like, oh, this speaks to me so much, this song. And I think a lot of young people are kind of feeling what I see saying young people, like you and I are ancient, but we're not. But people in the generation younger than us, a lot of them seem to be feeling this kind of sense of loss and anger and confusion with the world. And I think she put it into words pretty well. And I think a lot of older people maybe can't relate to that, and therefore just see a kid screaming about, you know, putting hexes on people on the stage. So I understand it. But I also think sometimes, I have to say, I think this is the worst instinct of the right. I have to say, I think sometimes the right just kind of looks at culture and says, I don't like that. I hate it. It's wrong. You know, give me, I don't know, Joe Dolan, and just forget any of this is happening. I think we have to look at it in the face and kind of say, well, why is it appealing? What's it saying? Because then we can figure out maybe what we should say in response to it. That's just
what I think. I'm not.
Naive. I'm not saying you were doing that.
No, I know, but it's not my cup of tea either way. And even if it was Joe Dolan, Eurovision's not really my jam. So it's, you know, it's not for me. I get that. Mm. But at the same time, it is a competition where the country is being represented by one act, and so it draws questions about whether or not that act is representative, etc., in a way that other musical events don't.
Well, I saw Laura Perrins writing about this week, and she basically said, look, if Bambi Thug wasn't wearing a trans flag, she wouldn't have been selected. That it was basically about driving home the politics. That's why she got selected, and I don't think that's 100% right, but I think there's truth to it as well.
Well, it's a bit like we were saying about politics. You know, you can be of the moment and you just can, you know, sail through in a different way.
Can I just say that you very nearly a minute ago, when you're saying a cup of tea, I heard you very nearly said cup of tea. I'm delighted we make a Monaghan woman of you yet.
I don't even know where that came from.
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted. I'm thrilled.
Oh, you're welcome.
Anyway, that's enough Eurovision, I think. Let's move on to something more cheerful. Any ideas for more cheerful topics there, Sarah?
No, I don't have a cheerful topic for you. I want to talk about the paedophile who was, or the man who was sentenced to a suspended sentence this week for viewing horrific child pornography. As cheerful things go, that ain't it, is it?
Yes, this is a former Department of Justice civil servant called, and I'm not going to say his name until I double check this in case I say the wrong name and get us both sued, but this is a Department of Justice former Department of Justice official called Niall Colligan, who was given a suspended sentence this week after being found in possession of, like, horrendous stuff. And this is a family podcast, so, I mean, but sorry, when I say it's a podcast, I mean, you could listen to it while without the kids present. So before I tell you what he was watching, just maybe make sure there are no kiddies in the room. And with that pause, if you haven't paused it, he was watching a video of basically 10-year-old boy having sex with another child. He was watching a video of a 14-year-old girl. A solo, I think, is the term that's used. All this was found in his possession. And Judge Martin Nolan, I don't want to make this about Judge Martin Nolan because you made very fair points about Judge Nolan in the past. But he decided that the appropriate sentence was no sentence. And more outrageously, I think, Sarah, he decided that one of the punishments was that Niall Colligan should go on the sex offenders register for a period of 5 years, after which time, presumably, he'd be cured. Can you cure paedophilia?
No, for starters. So I think paedophilia is an illness that is inside of you that can't be fixed. That's a hill I'll die on. I'm never going to be convinced that somebody who is subject to extremely intense therapy, et cetera, and spends 5 years on a list somewhere and is suddenly going to decide that they aren't sexually attracted to children any more than therapy is going to stop you from saying or from not liking tits. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not, it's innate, it's in you. I don't believe it's curable.
Now, they could beat me senseless for 5 or 6 years and I'd still love a good pair of boobs.
Yeah, exactly.
But
it's not curable. And also, he is partaking in some therapy and he's very, from what I've read, he's very remorseful and he's very cooperative with all of the things that he's being asked to do. Fair play to him. But I think it's a combination of things. I think it captures the imagination of things because of the sentencing parameters for child porn. I think it captures the imagination of things because, unfortunately, he works for the Department of Justice, which is just the cherry on top of a department that's already, completely a mess, as far as anybody who's a casual observer would say. And I think that it's capturing something about people who are very angry with the state of Ireland in so many ways. I don't think it's a sufficient punishment, obviously. I think that the punishment being described, you know, that the claim that because he's been exposed as who he is, somebody spray painted pedo on the outside of his home, he can no longer get car insurance or home insurance, probably because of, you know, the danger to his car and his home. God love him. But I don't know, there's something about this that's kind of interesting. The Department of Justice has been absolutely mitered with problems for the last few months. And this just seems to just click into that in a weird way. What do you think?
Well, I have a few thoughts. I won't start with the question you asked me, but I'll finish with it. My first is that I do feel sorry for paedophiles because, and I'll tell you why. I feel sorry for them because I don't think it's
something. I can see your comments now. People just get so angry.
Yeah. But bear with me. If you're shocked by that statement, bear with me because I think it's important that I kind of finish it. Because I agree with you that it's an illness, but it's also sexual orientation. And as I said, and I'd ask anyone at home to think about this, if you are somebody who is attracted to women, try and figure out what therapy could make you unattracted to women and attracted to men instead. And vice versa. If you're a woman sitting at home and you're attracted to men try and figure out what kind of therapy you could go through that could make you feel attracted to women instead. I just don't think it exists. And I think it's hilarious that we live in a society where, like, do you hear all this debate last year about the conversion therapy ban? You know, that we should ban people talking to trans kids because that's conversion therapy. And the worst thing that you could do, the worst torture you could inflict on a gay person, is try and convert them out of what they feel.
Yeah, we had that conversation, and I said that there was people close to me who I'd had that argument with, who, when they'd asked me what I would do if one of my children came out and told me they were trans, and I said they would get therapy, they accused me of being in favor of conversion therapy.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the same time, the state and the Department of Justice and the entire legal system basically takes the position that you can successfully perform conversion therapy on people who are attracted to children. Does that make any sense?
No.
It doesn't make any sense to me at all. So yeah. in that sense, I think that it should be considered, as you say, an illness and an affliction. But I also think you said about he should have received more punishment for it. I don't think that's the purpose of sending paedophiles to prison, because I don't think you can really be punished for that kind of stuff, because you can't theoretically control it. But the purpose of sending them to prison is to prevent the public. All of which, and this is the payoff, if you were somebody whose jaw was on the floor when I said I feel sorry for paedophiles, I think the correct, and I thought about this a lot, and I was initially appalled by the idea, but I think the correct treatment for paedophiles is chemical castration, to take sexual desire out of the equation entirely. Because that is the only way to stop them being a threat to children. And I think that is the appropriate punishment. And I think, you know, and I think there should be zero tolerance on it, because you and I are both of the internet age, Sarah. We both came, you know, we both came of age. I am sure that I'm not telling any secrets about either of us when I say that either accidentally or on purpose, both of us have encountered pornography in hundreds of times on the internet in our lives. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. Thanks, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
My dad listening to this episode. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. How many times have you encountered accidentally child pornography? Yeah. Can you hear me?
Broke up there for a second now.
Oh God, I have to edit that. But what I'm saying is, like, people on the internet who've come across porn in their lives, and everyone who's been on the internet in their life has come across porn, either deliberately or accidentally. How many of them have accidentally come across child pornography? No. It never happened to me. I'm guaranteed it's never happened to you, has it?
No, I've never seen anything. I've never seen any child porn. Not the kind that would accidentally come up, I'm sure.
If you have child porn in your possession, you have gone looking for it. Yeah. And you've gone looking for it in places in the internet that most people don't know exist. And yeah, you haven't actually gone out and physically abused a child, but you've got the intention to go and encourage others to do so, and you're a danger to society. And I think if your sexual desire is a danger to society like that, and we have a medical treatment and chemical castration that will restrict you from doing that, I think it's something we should seriously consider. That's where I'm coming from on this issue.
But are you talking about people who sexually abuse children, or people who view child porn, or are you equating the same? Are you saying?
I'm saying that it's a distinction without difference in my view.
Yeah.
Like, if you've displayed.
I'm not agreeing with you. I'm just asking.
Yeah, that's what I think. It's a distinction without difference. Because I think, like, with all these things, it's a pathway. If that's the kind of thing that floats your boat, if that's the kind of thing that turns you on, then it's always going to be the kind of thing that turns you on.
Can you
ever be trusted? Like, let's say you're released and it you do no harm for 20 years, and people in your family, your loved ones, kind of like almost forget that this happened, or think it's that one time thing that happened when you were in your 20s and going through a bad time, and then all of a sudden 25 years time, you somehow find yourself in the care of a 5-year-old with nobody else in the house that night. Can you be trusted?
No, I
don't think you can be. And that's just
always your point. I often wonder about, there's a lot of people out there who say, oh, you know, the person has served their time, and, you know, the things you're talking about are chemical castration and, you know, longer sentences, they're barbaric and they're not this and they're not that. All right, are you going to ask the person, would you have the person babysit your kids? No. So why would you, you know, I think that that's ultimately, and another thing that always bothers me about this, and I've just realized that I've done it myself in this conversation, is that it's not child porn, it's child abuse imagery. It's not porn. It's you're getting off on watching children being abused. It's a very different distinction. It's not, you're partaking in the abuse by watching it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not porn. But I think that one of the things that probably makes this interesting, and to go back to my point that I was making about him being this guy working in the Department of Justice and stuff, is that you're absolutely right. The part of the sentencing, when you sentence people for these kind of crimes, a huge part of it is to protect society from these people. You know, that's quite the kind of different from other crimes. And I think in Ireland at the moment, there's a number of examples where people really, and I really noticed this out canvassing with Niall Boylan, and people feel like the social contract is broken. Mm-hmm. And if you feel like that you're a taxpayer and you work really hard and you pay, you know, we pay big, high rates of tax and you're contributing to society and you're getting, you know, a tent city outside your door, you're getting facilities that don't work, you're getting a health service that don't work, you're getting housing, you're not getting housing, or it's extremely difficult for you to break into housing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now you're supposed to just, because of suspended sentence, you're just supposed to just accept that a paedophile lives next door to you as well, and there's nothing you can do about that either. And it's all kind of part of a picture where, you know, and I would often caveat this by saying, like, I don't think every single thing in Ireland is broken by any stretch of the imagination. I think there are some things that work well, but I think that there's been a breakdown in the relationship between society and politics. And that's really obvious when you're canvassing for these elections. And this is another example of that. Why should my kids walk around the streets of Dublin with that animal without any consequence for what he's done? He lives in an area where one of my best friends lives with her two kids. Why is he allowed? My friend lives near him, and she and her husband work their asses off to live in Ireland, to pay their taxes, got on the housing market, like put their kids into crèches so that they can go to work every day, contribute to society, coach the local teams, do all the stuff you're supposed to do to be a good Irish person in living in Ireland right now. And what do they get? Paedophile up the road because, you know, somebody might be outraged that he goes to jail. That's a breakdown in the social contract, in my opinion.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I want to make an additional point, which is that this has consequences, and it has consequences for people who could be innocent. Because one of the things that's really disturbing me at the moment is I'd say on three separate occasions in the last week, I've seen videos posted on X, what used to be Twitter, by various anonymous accounts, all showing the same thing. And the story is identical every time. It always involves a migrant, and it always involves a claim that the migrant in question tried to take somebody's kids. Yeah. And it always involves, like, local big men dispensing justice to that individual, whether that be a few kicks or a few whacks, or as somebody in central Dublin just today, Thursday, we're recording this on a Thursday, was apparently left lying knocked out on the street because maybe, and I'm not saying he didn't commit the crime, I don't know. But I'm saying when there's that atmosphere out there that, you know, this kind of stuff is tolerated or that the state is some way facilitating it, somebody innocent is going to get the crap beaten out of them in the most horrendous way by angry people who are just looking to take it out on somebody. I have to say I watch those videos and I cringe, because it's, you know, call the cops if you suspect that sort of thing. If you suspect you've seen somebody committing a crime, by all means corner them, by all means restrain them. But this business of beating people up, it might make you feel like a big man, but like, there's every chance you could be wrong. But I think.
Well, I mean, hold on a second, right? I think that in a scenario, and there was a scenario with a 2-year-old being attempted to be pulled out of a buggy last week, or was it the week before that was all over the news?
It was last week, yeah. It was in the inner city.
Right. So that, as you say, temperatures are, you know, flaring or whatever at the moment. The atmosphere is heated, right? And I know the inner city, the South inner city very well. And I have lots of friends who live down there, and a couple of them spring to mind as we're having this conversation. And if they saw somebody trying to or doing anything to do with a kid, they would knock them out. And I'm here for it, to be honest. I'm not talking about a crowd of people, you know, deciding that someone is and running after somebody because they've decided. I'm talking about if you actually witness something. I think most men would get involved and get physical with somebody that they thought were doing something to endanger the welfare of a child.
Yeah, for sure. If somebody needs restraining, restrain them. That's what I'm saying. I'm not disagreeing. But what I'm saying is, like, with three or four of these incidents in the last week, they've all been on social media. Were each and every one of those people guilty? Maybe. Maybe it'll come out they were all guilty. But I'm saying that the more this happens, the greater the chances that something innocent gets misinterpreted or, you know, or that somebody gets attacked for standing too near a child rather than doing anything. So, like, this all comes down to what you were talking about, the social contract. When people stop trusting the state to act on these matters, and people see paedophiles walk. I mean, fair play. I want to say something else, because, you know, people always accuse me of not standing up for working class people or being opposed to working class candidates. Fair play to Gavin Pepper. Can I say that? Because he when that lad came out, the guy we were talking about, Colgan, came out of the court the other day. Gavin Pepper, who is a local election candidate in Finglas, was there with a kind of homemade sign that was targeting the judge rather than Peter. But he followed him down the street and he made a video, which I think was absolutely on point, saying, look, why aren't we being protected from people like this? Why? And he's the first politician in Ireland that I can remember in living memory making the sentencing in courts an issue. So more power to him. You know, if he gets elected on that alone, it'll be a message worth sending. Now, obviously, if he gets elected, people will say it was because of immigration and all the rest of it. But, I mean, fair play to him for actually making that a political issue, because it is a political issue.
Yeah.
Too many politicians treat the courts as kind of like entirely independent and totally separate and nothing to do with us. And whatever sentences the judges hand down, they hand down. But let me tell you something. Your defense of the judge in question, Martin Nolan, and I think it's a really good defense. And correct me if I'm wrong, but your defense is basically he's
going to get nailed in the comments now. I'm not defending him, I'm explaining.
Right, but
explain. Parameters for child pornography possession that need to change, but he doesn't have the power to give this guy, for example, a 30-year sentence. He's not able to do that because of the way the laws, because of the sentencing. There are sentencing parameters for that crime. Absolutely, 100%, they need to change, for sure, right? But in this situation, Martin Nolan has things that he has to consider. He has to consider mitigating factors, things like cooperation with the police and the investigation, remorse, entering into a treatment program, first offense. They're all called mitigating factors. They all have to be considered. Like, it's not as simple as it's played out to be. And I'm not defending Martin Nolan because there's lots of other things. But we have to get serious about making our sentences serious.
Yeah. No, preach, sister. I mean, I'm agreeing with you.
Like, if it was up to me, proven possession of child abuse materials would be a 10 to 15 year mandatory sentence, right? But at the moment, it isn't. He can't give a 15-year sentence. It's not in his power to do so.
Yeah.
So and I get that Martin Nolan is just, people hate Martin Nolan and that's their decision, that's their right and everything. But we need to address the sentencing parameters for these crimes. That's where we win the battle.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's the point I was going to make. Like, you know, when I say fair play to Gavin Pepper for making it a political issue, I mean, politicians refuse to make it a political issue, even though they are more to blame than Judge Nolan is for the sentence that man received.
Yes.
They are the ones who set the sentencing parameters. They're the ones who wrote the law. They have it within their power tomorrow to write a new law saying possession of child abuse material shall result in a sentence of incarceration not less than 7 years or 10 years or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
They have it in their power to do that. They don't do it.
And that's the defense of Martin Nolan. Martin Nolan will, like, you know, makes bad calls all the time, right? But he is still bound by the limitations of what is in front of him. And politicians it suits politicians for everybody to hate Martin Nolan because it takes the attention away from them. They are the legislators. They can do something about this. They don't.
And it's the same across a whole range of issues, not just this one. But yeah, I think it's a really important conversation to have. And I want to come back. Like, I just think the conversion therapy point is the main one. We live in a society that says nobody's sexual orientation can be changed except paedophiles. They're the only ones who can be treated. Like, you can't be unstraighted. I can't be unstraighted. Panty Bliss can't be ungayed, and nobody can be detransed. But if you're a paedophile and you're into really little kids, you can be cured. It just makes no sense. And it's just one of those things that's widely accepted without debate. Because people are, I think, afraid to say it. And so when I say I have sympathy for paedophiles, I say I have sympathy for paedophiles in that I do feel sorry for anyone afflicted with that. But I do also think you're a threat to society. And, you know, if it was up to me, as they say, give them some chemicals, make sure they can never feel sexual desire again. I mean, we're doing it to transgender kids all the time. Why not do it to paedophiles?
I mean, I think that they are predators, and I think that it's very hard for me to summon any kind of...
Well, I think in fairness, it should be said that I presume there are a significant number of people who experience that desire who never act on it and realize that it's very bad and probably seek therapy and seek help managing those impulses.
Yeah, I think
it's not fair to say that.
I don't want to meet them, but yeah, okay, fine. But the ones that come to our attention are the ones who do act on it, and they are predatory, and they, you know, hide in plain sight, and I don't feel sorry for any of them.
All right, well, let's talk about something cheerier. We said we weren't going to talk much Irish politics, and we've kind of touched on it with sentencing, but let's talk Argentinian politics instead. You've been very impressed with the president down there, Mr. Milei.
Well, it's just gas, isn't it? It's a bit like everything in Ireland, but there's an ideology in Ireland that's, you know, the predominant ideology of the media, and all other ideologies are kind of bad. And Milei's come into power in Argentina. He's a colourful character, not unlike Trump in many ways. Horrified the sensibilities of people, you know, on the left in Ireland, and I suppose, would it be fair to say worldwide, or definitely Western worldwide? Mm. And he just started hacking away at all of the established establishment structures in Argentina over the last while, and much to the horror of everybody watching. And now this week we're seeing inflation in Argentina is down from 300% to 11%. They've had the first quarterly budget surplus since 2008. Interest rates have been cut three times in 3 weeks. And the Argentinian peso has become the world's best performing currency. So I think that there are people who can disagree with the way he does things or whatever, but you really have to start asking yourself whether or not some of his ideology is working, if only for Argentina.
Well, we were talking a minute ago, Sarah, about how one can't change their sexual orientation. But let me tell you something. After you saying all that, if I ever become gay, Mr. Milei is going to be my dream man.
You'll have to fight my husband off because he's obsessed with him. Like, you know, like, Argentina has been a badly performing country economically for quite a while. And this is just a complete turnaround. I mean, he's doing... And the other thing that always strikes me about... You know, the commentary in Ireland sometimes about America, and commentary in Ireland in the Irish media about Argentina as well. You don't have to live there. Like, he got elected democratically. Maybe the voters of Argentina know something more about Argentina than you do. Mm-hmm. Clearly they do. Because this guy's come in, I can't remember the numbers now, so I don't want to misquote them, but he reduced the amount of government departments down by a huge amount. He cut costs left, right and centre for things that he deemed to be nonsense. He got rid of all kinds of departments that would, I mean, leave people in Ireland weeping in the street. You know, the kind of vagina monologues on ice department and whatever else nonsense there was there. And like, it's working. And people said, you know, it reminds me a bit of, and again, we've had this conversation many times on the podcast before, not saying I'm a Donald Trump fan, but when Donald Trump was running against Hillary, all I ever heard from people was that he was going to start a war, that he was insane, he's a warmonger, he's going to have the nuclear codes, and it was going to be so terrible and everyone was going to die. And least interventionist president in living memory, no wars, and, you know, that just didn't happen. And again, here they talked about it was going to collapse Argentina and it was going to be terrible, and, you know, the people would be starving, whatever. No. Hasn't played out that way. It doesn't mean that everything he does is right. Doesn't mean that everything Donald Trump does. But it just exposes the lack of critical thinking and the inability of a lot of the commentary to drop their bias and analyze things on their own merit.
Well, one of the problems we have is that the entire commentariat, particularly in a country like Ireland, is not only biased ideologically against somebody like Milei, they also have like a rooting interest in making sure that never happens here. Like, because if somebody like me, or indeed your beloved husband, were to take power in the morning and do his chainsaw thing, I mean, what would go? I mean, all the state funding to the newspapers.
I think our loyal listeners can guess what my answer is going to be. First up on the chopping block, National Women's Council of Ireland.
But not only them. Bye-bye RTE, bye-bye all the state advertising to the Irish Times, bye-bye all the funding that goes to the Independent and the Examiner and the Journal and all the rest of them. So first of all, journalists have a rooting interest in making sure somebody like that never gets power in this country. Not only do they have a rooting interest, all the aforementioned National Women's Councils, NGOs, all that sort of stuff, they have a rooting interest in making this guy sound like a monster, because God forbid, if somebody like that ever took power here, it's not going to be a middle-class family who pays the price. It's going to be our friends in the academic department, the women's studies department in UCD. It's going to be our college students protesting in Trinity College for whatever they're protesting about in relation to Israel this week, who find that their jobs in sociology are actually limited. So, this massive infrastructure that we've built up, and this is one of the challenges that the right in general in the West has, is that the left have built this massive dependent infrastructure that's dependent on the state and sucks taxpayer money out of it to keep themselves fed, but also has so much power that it's kind of formed this massive state blob voting bloc that stands in the way of any attempts to tame it. And I think you need to do, I mean, Milei campaigned with a chainsaw. He literally went around with a chainsaw cutting random things to demonstrate how much spending he was about to cut. And then, you know, bugger me, not only did he campaign on it, he went and did it. He actually did it.
That's the other thing. He proves that, like, sometimes if you get power, you can do it. Mm-hmm. It's not all just, do you know what I mean? And like, I appreciate that in Ireland, we have this thing where, you know, we never, like, I can't, in my adult life, we've never had a single party government. So they go on their manifestos and then they have to negotiate that all down. Fine. Okay. We're all adults. We can understand that as a concept. But he sort of makes the case for being able to say you're going to do something and then go in and actually do it. Mm-hmm.
The BBC's coverage of it is hilarious, by the way. The BBC is Javier Milei, president denies ordinary Argentines paying for austerity cuts. And then it uses the example of Julia, a 72-year-old retired chef who is now struggling to make ends meet on her monthly pension of $190 or about £150 sterling. And he says that like, you know, his cuts are damaging. But actually, if you think about this, 300% inflation is much more damaging if you're on an income that low. Because it means literally everything is going up in price 300% every year while your income is standing stable. It's actually better. It's actually better for you if your income goes down a little bit, but inflation collapses. And inflation is collapsing under his leadership. I mean, this is something that, you know, my God, I think we're trying to make enemies in the comments this week. But this is something Margaret Thatcher proved in the early 80s in Britain, in the early 80s, when she went through a period of massive austerity to get inflation down, and it worked. I'm not saying that you have to agree with all her economics, but that's something she went through as well. And this is a time.
You won't be reading out any comments next week, but yeah, okay. Hmm.
So I think we're agreed we could use a Milei type figure. And you know what's fascinating? There's another way you know this guy is doing well. You know what it is?
Silence.
Silence. Mm-hmm. Silence. I mean, because when Jair Bolsonaro was president of Brazil for 4 years, and he was everyone's most hated sort of fascist, and then more so after Donald Trump took a leave of absence from the US presidency, I mean, barely a week went past without some word of a Bolsonaro outrage of some kind in Brazil. Whereas as now, when you're not hearing anything about Argentina, you know things are going pretty well, because you can be guaranteed if Milei starts, you know, his program starts failing, it'll be everywhere. So the silence is...
How predictable. Yeah, I know. I mean, if you're not hearing about it, it must be going well. And that's because it doesn't fit the agenda. But that comes back to the point that we've made many times before, which is that there's a lack of, you know, critical thinking. I don't trust the analysis anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, I trust people more who can, and I often do this with people, you know, Donald Trump is a really good example of it, where I say to people, is there anything? And they do this sometimes in American debates, you know, name one good thing about your opponent. If you can't say one thing about good thing that someone has done, you're undermining your entire ability to comment, really, if you ask me. Like, I can say Mary Lou is a really good election performer and a really good speaker and a very good debater. What does it cost me? Nothing. Doesn't mean I agree with her, but it's fine. If you can't admit that something is going well, I just don't really care to hear your analysis when all you want to talk about is when it's going badly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I always say this, like, about my friends at Journal Media. It's not that I don't trust their analysis, because sometimes there are pieces on the journal that I think are very good. Mm. And in some ways, I can't criticize any outlet for having an ideological bias, because I edit one that has an ideological bias. Mm-hmm. But what I really find about them is that I don't trust their motivations.
Yeah.
Like, so I can predict the things they'll do fact checks on, the things they won't.
Yeah.
You know, it is down to the last T. This is all about promoting their message. They will never fail to take an opportunity to fact check some nobody independent candidate over in Roscommon who said something stupid about, you know, planes dousing the sky with chemicals. Really pissing off the commenters now, by the way. But they absolutely won't fact check a government minister who says something that's completely false.
But also, in fairness, John, you are the editor of a media outlet that is very upfront about its ideological position, and they're not.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have a duty to be. Right? I mean, and that's why I write two pieces a day myself, so everyone knows I'm the editor. This is what I think. This is what I actually think about. I very rarely write news pieces, because I think, and my pieces are never the most read on Gripped. They're never, I mean, you know, I'm constantly like third or fourth in the rankings. But I think it's important that people can, you know, have a conversation with you as the editor, and this is what I think, this is why I think you're wrong. And then you can come back to me and say, well, actually, no, you're wrong. I think that's important for building trust. And I think I'm really proud of the relationship we have with our readers because of that. You know, and I know there are loads of them who I sometimes wish would be a bit milder in their criticism. But I think it's important that I hear that criticism, and I read it, and I see what they're saying, and I'm free to say, you know, you're wrong, back to them. I think that is an atmosphere of honesty and trust that just doesn't exist, not only in the rest of the media, but between government and people anymore. There's this constant kind of like the government just doesn't trust the public with certain facts or information, as we saw during the referendum. Mm. We've talked about politics again, haven't we?
Sorry.
Yeah, it's terrible. Anyway, Niall Boylan has no posters up yet. When's that happening?
No, they're going up. They're going up slowly. The European elections, I mean, one of the things I've noticed in the last week, and it's really stark, is how much money Fine Gael are putting in behind Regina Doherty. Billboards, bus stops, holy God. So we're volunteer base, so we're putting up our posters predominantly by volunteers. A couple of people are being paid a few quid, but they go up slowly but surely. But he's out and about, and man, they love him. Gas. So it's going really well from that point of view. But
are you seriously on this podcast going to do the great response on the door shtick?
I actually am, because you know why? Because I can actually say it with the benefit of having experienced when it's not.
Okay.
And also, it's true. People come over, right? I really am not exaggerating, time and time again, and say, absolutely not, and walk by, and then realize that it's not Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil or the Greens or whoever, and then turn around and say, oh God, no, Boland, sorry about that. No, yeah, no, I'm definitely voting Green. The hate and anger out there for the government parties is palpable.
Okay. Well, we will have, I will have, you won't be there, obviously, because that would just be terrible. But I'll have Niall Boylan on before the elections, and he and I will have a conversation for the benefits of the listeners so that they can, so that more of them can say that to him, or indeed say something more negative to him. We'll find out. And as I say, I will be back on Monday with a half hour edition of, not this show, but it'll be similar in format to this show, with Pádraig Tobin to begin with. He is number one. He is certainly not going to be the last one, to tell us why people should vote for any two candidates in the upcoming European elections. And I look forward very much to that conversation. Sarah, have you anything more to add before we let the folks go and enjoy their weekend?
No, that's it from me.
And that is it from me. So thank you so much for listening. As ever, we do read your comments. We don't always refer to them, but we do read them. So please be nice. At least be nice to Sarah. I don't care if you're nice to me or not. And we'll be back with another edition of this next week, as ever. Until then, from Sarah and from me, that was the week that really was.